This is the voice of the Trumpet Magazine. News, economy, politics, trends, discovery, health, family, the Bible, the future. This is Trumpet Hour, the week in review.
Welcome to the Trumpet's weekly review of all the important news. I'm Joel Hilliker, and with me is our panel here in the studio. We have Jeremiah Jacques.
Hello there.
And Andrew Miller.
Hello.
From our office in Britain, we have Richard Palmer.
Good afternoon.
And Brent Noctegal.
Good to be with you.
The world is experiencing a very difficult time right now. Massive disruptions to national economies and to regular life for just about everyone. On top of the health crisis, there's a great need to pull together to successfully face these challenges. In America, though, we're not pulling together. We're growing more divided, it seems, by the day. Everything is political. There's finger pointing everywhere, accusations and greater problems. And in this climate of hostility, the issue of racial division has come roaring back. For this story, we will turn to Andrew Miller.
Yeah, riots are breaking out across America over the death of George Floyd. Now, George Floyd was arrested this Monday towards the beginning of the week, but so much has happened since then that it definitely feels like more than a week sometimes. But to catch everyone up on kind of what happened is George Floyd was arrested in Minneapolis on Monday, and the police officer that arrested him, an onlooker, recorded the incident and posted it online so we can tell exactly what happened, or at least what happened during the arrest. He pinned him to the ground. He was trying to get him in the police vehicle, and he pinned him to the ground, and he put his knee on his neck to restrain him, which is a banned arrest technique in the Minneapolis police book, rule book. But he was trying to restrain him, and he put his knee on his neck, and he was moaning that he couldn't breathe, and he kept his knee on there for, I guess, probably about 5 minutes. And by that point, he was probably so oxygen surprised, he was a little more sedate. They were able to get him in the police car. But the injuries must have been worse than the police officer thought. I don't think they've seen any evidence that he intended to kill him. But he did die from the damage to his throat later that day. And then the video leaked online, and so then you start having a protest break out with people out in the streets with chanting hands up, don't shoot, and I can't breathe. And so the chief of police in Minneapolis, he fired that police officer and the three police officers involved in the arrest, and then President Trump got involved, sending out a tweet that my heart goes out to George's family and friends. Justice will be served. And then he had announced that he'd asked the Federal Bureau of Investigation and the Justice Department, both of them, to investigate the death, see exactly what happened. And then I think the mayor of Minneapolis issued a condemnation of the techniques as well. So that seems like there's a lot of action against this on the city and federal level, though it doesn't seem to have calmed any of the emotion over the death down. The protest with the hands up, don't shoot continued. And then on Tuesday and Wednesday night, they escalated into a full-scale rioting and looting. They had like Walgreens on fire and looting convenience stores. They had several buildings on fire with people with power tools trying to break into the ATM. And it is mostly the rioting's divided on racial lines. I'm not saying all the protesters are black and all the people who support the police are are white, but it is largely the black, because George Floyd was black, and the officer who put the knee on the neck was a white police officer. I don't know if there's any evidence that he put his knee on his neck because he was black. He may have done it just because he was conducting an arrest and got and got carried away with the techniques he used to get him in the police car. But it's gone into rioting, and the riots have gotten worse because there was one convenience store got looted, and the owner of the convenience store shot one of the looters trying to protect his store. And then he was arrested, the owner of the convenience store was arrested for that as well. And then you saw something happen this time that I haven't seen that I can remember in other riots where they've actually have like militia types, like country people, long beards, long rifles, who are standing with their guns in front of the convenience stores. They saying that, hey, the data shows that the police are less likely to be brutal if there's armed citizens on the ground. Even one man was saying that, he says, I figure before there were cops, there were just Americans. So here we are, bottom line, justice for Floyd. And I hope to stop the looting at some point. And so I don't think any of those people have hurt anybody yet, but it is starting to get a backlash from, or even like two sides to this. You've got rioters, African-American rioters on the one side, and then you've got these country militia types, mostly white, on the other side. And with the emotional tension in a situation like that, that could spiral out of control very easily.
Mm-hmm. Stephen Fleury did an excellent job this morning on the Trumpet Daily Radio Show talking about this and just how the way that the mayor of Minneapolis responded and the way that the police responded. They pulled the police out of the situation entirely for several hours to allow the people to destroy as they wanted to. He was pointing back to what had happened in Baltimore 5 years ago, where you had... they deliberately told the law enforcement to stand down and to give the rioters space to destroy. And that's essentially what you had happening here. The mayor of Minneapolis saying that it was more important to protect the lives of the officers than it was to protect the buildings. You know, lives are more important than brick and mortar, that type of thing. And one there was a website that printed just the list of the buildings damaged and looted in Minneapolis and St. Paul. There's over 70 buildings that suffered significant damage, and yet these leaders are coming out there and saying, well, it's justified what the rioters are doing. The left thinks that it's just that people are indiscriminately destroying things and stealing things, and in many cases, like I think Stephen Fleury brought out a bit on his program this morning, these are the same people who they're so outraged that people are breaking quarantine for coronavirus, and yet they're pleased to see this kind of violence taking place on the streets because of the racial component to it.
Right, and that type of thinking is really dangerous, because a case like this, I mean, between the mayor of Minneapolis and the governor of Minnesota, they've got the resources to take care of this. They're just not doing it. And if they don't do it, then you're going to force President Trump to send in the National Guard and take care of it himself. And I think he even sent out a couple tweets this week announcing that he would do just that. If these local officials don't get their act together, you're going to have to use federal officials to protect lives and property. But that is another thing where once you start seeing people get kind of twitchy when the... you see the National Guard on the streets. That's and especially anything this political environment, anything President Trump does,
right,
is going to be viewed as a move towards fascism in the United States. So it would be nice if they let him sit this one out and just take the handle this at the local level, but that's probably not going to happen.
It's definitely another case where you see disunity and division in this country. It's a deadly curse. Mr. Fleury has often pointed to Jesus Christ talking about the fact that a house divided cannot stand. I would really encourage people to listen to that Trumpet Daily Radio program from this morning from Stephen Fleury. Anything that you want to say just as far as the prophetic implications of what we're looking at here?
Right. Well, We can put in the show notes an article from Mr. Fleury, Mr. Gerald Fleury, Police Under Attack, where he really points out too that there there is some incidences of racism in American law enforcement, but there's also a lot of people who are stirring up emotion and anger and magnifying these issues beyond bigger than they are. For selfish reasons, to get votes or to win an election, try to make President Trump look like a racist so people will vote for the other side. And that emotion is really creating this this division and anger. And Mr. Stephen Fleury in this Trumpet radio program this morning already talked quite a bit about Isaiah 1. And verse 7, where it's talking about this is a prophecy. You look at all these Walgreens and these Wendy's on fire, and there's this prophecy about it. So your country is desolate. Your cities are burned with fire. Your land, strangers devour it, and your presence, it's desolate. It's overthrown by strangers. And then just a little later in the chapter, it's talking about, he said, except the Lord of hosts had left unto us a very small remnant, we should have been as Sodom, and we should have been likened to Gomorrah. And you definitely, and it's, you read about Sodom and Gomorrah, there was hardly any righteous people left in that city, and it was completely blotted out. And so that's talking about how bad these problems get with these cities burned with fire, to the point that God has a plan to save it, but it's it gets pretty close to Sodom and Gomorrah levels before he can use that small remnant to solve these problems.
Do listen to that Trumpet Daily Radio Show. I think it's just really much needed listening in times like this. And thank you very much for that, Andrew. We spoke last week about this new law that China is passing in Hong Kong that many analysts say marks the end of a free Hong Kong. Well, that law has been passed. To learn more about it, we will turn to Jeremiah Jacques.
Yes, last week, this law was something that might happen. But over the last week, the bill was backed by China's National People's Congress. Then yesterday, it was approved by Parliament with a vote of 2,878 in favor of the bill and one apparently very brave soul against it. So that's, you know, that's China's rubber stamp parliament. There's very little opposition to anything there. So the law still has to be formally approved by the Standing Committee of the Communist Party. They'll be the ones that actually draw up the full details. But all those details are just technicalities and will not prevent this Chinese law from going into force over Hong Kong. And right there is really why this is such a big story. It's a law from mainland China that'll be enforced over Hong Kong. So that is just a clear violation of the model called One Country, Two Systems that's supposed to define the entire relationship between China and Hong Kong. That's an agreement that dates back to 1997 when Great Britain, which had Hong Kong as a colony and really built it up from nothing into a mecca of finance and commerce, and then in 1997, they gave it to China. And the Hong Kongers at that time were terrified that their unique and democratic and free system would be swallowed up by the authoritarian mainland. So Britain convinced China to promise Hong Kong that for at least 50 years, the government and people of Hong Kong would be able to stay largely free and keep on writing their own laws and running their own economy the way they wanted to, and basically just maintaining that unique system that they inherited from Great Britain. So what just happened this week is just a clear and flagrant violation of that promise. We've spoken on the show many times about the protests that Hong Kongers have been engaged in for, well, since June of last year, almost a year now. And that's been just a huge humiliation to China. And China had tried several times over the last year to convince Hong Kong to pass laws that would criminalize much of the behavior associated with those protests, just as that kind of behavior is criminalized in mainland China. But the Hong Kong legislature was always deadlocked and never able to pass it. So now China has just bulldozed over the whole one-party, two-system deal and passed the law themselves instead. So I think it really is hard to overstate just how momentous this is. But for Hong Kong, it's just about the worst news they could imagine, because it does mean that the days are numbered for their freedoms. It means unaccountable enforcers will be able to impose the Chinese Communist Party's whims in Hong Kong. It means anyone who protests in Hong Kong could be arrested at any time, even for something like posting a message online that that the party doesn't like. That could be enough to land you in the custody of the CCP, the Chinese Communist Party. And if you know anything about the Chinese justice system, you know that that's just a horrifying possibility.
Do you want to just talk about that a bit, just why the Hong Kongers are so dead set against living under the Chinese justice system?
Sure, yeah. Yeah, the Chinese justice system, I actually think it should not technically even be called a justice system, because there's very, very little justice in there. It's a tool used by the Chinese Communist Party to punish their enemies and to protect and expand their own power. So instead of rule of law in China, it's rule of the party. This new law, for example, that the CCP is enacting for Hong Kong, it actually sounds like a reasonable law when you hear it. It says it will criminalize splittism, subversion, and terrorism in Hong Kong, and any behavior that gravely threatens national security. That's some of the wording from the draft that's been released. So in another country, that would sound reasonable enough. But the CCP is just famous for defining terms like subversion and even terrorism with just spectacular broadness. You know, in the mainland, they apply laws like that on anyone who they see as insufficiently submissive to the Communist Party. That's happened with someone sending not an online publicly posted message, but a private text message.
They're monitoring text.
Right. They monitor private messages on WeChat, which is like a Chinese version of Twitter, I guess. But even the backdoor part of it, the direct messages, the government monitors. And there was one man who was arrested because he had joked about a party official. Another person was arrested for criticizing a poorly placed police traffic stop. In the middle of the rain, they had decided to put a traffic stop, but he just made a remark to a family member about it, and he wound up at the mercy of this judicial system. He was branded as a subversive. And so once a person is branded like that, branded as a subversive or perhaps even a terrorist, he might face detention without trial. He might face torture to extract a confession. If he does end up in a court, he would have a 99.9% chance of being convicted. And then if the sentence is execution, which it very often is in China, China executes more people than the entire world combined. And execution is generally carried out within 72 hours of a verdict being rendered. So very little chance of an appeal or even to inform family members of what's going on. It can all happen very, very fast and for very, very little. And I think that's what makes all of this so terrifying to the people of Hong Kong.
Mm-hmm. It sounds very much like what you saw in Russia under Stalin, except that there's the technological aspect of it, being able to monitor and to surveil people on a much, much stricter scale. So you have written an article about this, or working on an article, and you contacted one individual over there in Hong Kong. What did you hear from him?
Yes. Yeah, we have established a contact with what seems to be a reasonably well-placed individual. He seems able to understand the dynamic very well. And yeah, I'll just read through a couple of the statements he told me here. He said, "The implication behind this is huge. The passing of this national security law means the unique freedoms Hong Kong has enjoyed since the territory was handed to China by Great Britain are officially dead." And then he said, "Everything has been taken under control of the Chinese Communist Party." And then one really salient statement from him says, "They are no longer hiding their evil plans." So I think that one is particularly insightful because it shows that China has long had these plans. You know, the CCP has always wanted to be an unquestioned dictatorial system, but they used to sort of lie about it and hide those ambitions and promise autonomy to Hong Kong and things like that. But now it's no longer hiding it. The CCP is just steamrolling over those freedoms without concern for how it looks to the rest of the world. And I do think that we are seeing a big shift here with China. They've lost a lot of clout in recent months with the rest of the world over the coronavirus. And even with the Belt and Road Initiative being seen for the trap that it is for many countries. And it's, you know, I think instead of reforming and apologizing and changing, China is hardening. And just it's emboldened and just suddenly more cold and more just kind of hell-bent on subduing all enemies. So I think that what we're talking about, whether it's with Hong Kong or Tibet or Xinjiang or even Taiwan, the, you know, also the South China Sea, India, suddenly China is pushing so hard against just about everyone all at once. And it's kind of shifting into an era of rule by fear. Mm-hmm. In an era when, as my contact said there, they don't try to even hide their tyrannical ambitions anymore.
I'd like to bring Richard in on this a little bit. When you talk about just the fact that China is working so hard to position itself as the leader of a new world economy and its interactions with other nations are so critical, other nations that are watching this are, the response is very interesting. When you contrast, say, what the way that the United States is responding with some other nations. Can you just talk about that a bit, Richard?
Yeah, I think that it has been very interesting. You've had the UK, Canada, and Australia get together and put out some very critical statements against China. You've had the UK take a significant step already, saying, well, if China goes ahead and implements this law, we're going to let Hong Kong citizens move to the UK and put in a place of process for them to become UK citizens. So all of those highly skilled members of people living in Hong Kong that have made this a financial powerhouse, Britain is giving them an avenue to escape China in a way then that would make Hong Kong much less valuable potentially to the Chinese Communist Party. Then you've had the United States with President Trump and Secretary of State Mike Pompeo talking about revoking China's exceptional or Hong Kong's exceptional status, saying, well, it no longer counts as kind of being outside of main China and some of the exceptions that granted it, getting rid of those, potentially even putting on sanctions on Hong Kong. So you're looking at some real steps from Britain and America and other of these English-speaking countries. And I don't want to overstate the steps that they're taking. I don't think China is necessarily quaking in their boots right now because of what Britain and America are saying. And I think it's unlikely that these steps would be significant enough to make them reverse course, but they're doing something. And then you have a very different response from the European Union, and European leaders are getting together today to talk about their response. But they've already said, we are not going to put sanctions in place. So already right off the bat, they've basically said, well, we might give you, we'll probably give you a telling off and have some words against China. And absolutely, as Jeremiah said, I think this has changed Europe's opinion of China. But they're not going to stop working with them. You know, maybe they'll be more cautious. Maybe they'll look out for their own interests a bit more in that relationship. But they've made absolutely clear they're still working on this. Politico has a good article where they talk about how Germany's just really focused on getting a new investment agreement with China. And so their focus in this is making sure that this investment agreement still goes through and that what's happening in Hong Kong doesn't derail that. One senior EU diplomat said sanctions are not on the table. Our relations with the Chinese are simply too important. So a very different approach from Europe. This is too important for us to let things like democracy, fate of 3 million people in Hong Kong, you know, that can't derail our ties with China.
Yeah, which is exactly what you would expect given the prophecies that we refer to time and time again as far as the Mart of Nations prophecy in Isaiah between China and the European nations, and the fact that they are actually going to align themselves to come together against America and the English speaking nations that you spoke about. It is an interesting stark contrast in response between those two groups, which divide precisely along the line that Bible prophecy says the split takes place. Jeremiah, do you want to just bring it home with why this is so significant, prophetically speaking?
Yes, sure. The editor-in-chief of the Philadelphia Trumpet, Mr. Gerald Fleury, wrote an article for our February 2020 issue. It's called The Climax of Man's Rule Over Man. And this article really zeroes in on a prophecy saying that in the end time, the world would go from having the United States and the UK as the main global powers to a new era called the Times of the Gentiles. And this will be a time when China becomes one of the main global powers. And so when you look at Hong Kong, it's actually a remarkable, almost like a case study, where we can see in very direct, almost a time-lapsed way, just what it means to transition from Anglo rule, you know, Pax Britannia, Pax Americana, to these times of the Gentiles, when rule by nations such as China will instead be the main global force. Under Britain, Hong Kong became a thriving and incredibly wealthy hub of commerce, just a populous and prosperous place. And the Hong Kongers really missed that. You know, no one says the British rule was perfect, but it was overwhelmingly positive. And the Hong Kongers inherited many amazing freedoms, which they cherish. And that's why when you look at protesters today, you see so many of the Hong Kong protesters brandishing the Union Jack, even the American flag, just because they know that those systems mean freedom and prosperity, especially when you compare it to the Chinese system that's now taking over. And Hong Kong is now going to be a police state ruled by fear, ruled by force, and it'll be a place where people do exactly what the Chinese Communist Party says, or else they'll be dealt with in the harshest imaginable ways, including being killed. That's the kind of leadership that is replacing British rule. And Mr. Fleury's article shows that situations like the shift in Hong Kong are only just the beginning. One part of his article says, "These times of the Gentiles are yet to be fully realized. However, we are in the outer edges of this catastrophic storm. Russia's and China's actions prove that the Gentiles are rising to power before our eyes." And then skipping down a little, it says, "This is the ghastly culmination of 6,000 years of man's rule over man. This is the nightmare awaiting mankind just ahead." So it's really tragic, I think, to see what's happening in Hong Kong, and it's even more tragic to know that this is just a small preview of how tumultuous the whole world is fast on its way to becoming.
Critical perspective to have as you watch what's happening over there. The name of that article, again, The Climax of Man's Rule Over Man. We'll put a link in the show notes to that article, as well as you can watch for Jeremiah's article. This is the end of a free Hong Kong that should be going up on the website soon. Keep that perspective in mind as you watch what's happening there. Thanks for that, Jeremiah. Iran has been hurting from sanctions, from coronavirus, but that hasn't stopped it from its aggressive militancy and continuing to sponsor terrorism. Well, this week it seems to have found another customer for its oil exports that continues this provocative trend. For this story, we'll turn to Brent Noctegal.
Yeah, this week we saw the arrival of five tankers holding petrol arrive in Venezuelan waters. These left Iran at the beginning of the month and then sailed across the Atlantic. And there has been a number of back and forths between the United States and Iran over the past couple of weeks about the fate of these tankers, with the United States deploying four warships to the Caribbean and also reconnaissance planes to the area to monitor what was going to happen with these tankers. But the United States let them pass. They went through the Suez Canal and they reached Venezuelan waters. These are tankers that are full of petroleum that will be used in cars and things like that to help the economy go ahead in Venezuela, at least for a little bit. Not oil. Venezuela doesn't need oil, of course. They have the largest oil reserves in the world, and yet they lack the refining capacity right now to produce, you know, to make it into a usable form. And so what we're seeing now is Iran come to the rescue and supply at least a little bit to tie them over for a few weeks towards a month of the ability that they the petrol that Venezuela is going to need. And then we've also got Iran over the past couple of weeks flying some of its Mayan Air. It's a national carrier of Iran. And we actually have Mayan Air flying over jets full of replacement parts and also personnel, Iranian personnel, to Venezuela to help fix the refineries and help help Venezuela get those up and going. And already in May, we have seen 100% increase in refining capacity of Venezuela. And so it's really interesting here. We have two friends that both are under U.S. sanctions, meaning Iran's not allowed to sell oil to anybody, and Venezuela's not allowed to technically not allowed to buy Iranian oil. And yet you have them working with each other because they both are under U.S. sanction. And the only way that the U.S. can actually stop this, it seems, is by direct military action, which it has refrained from doing thus far.
But still, to see Iran making its way into the Western Hemisphere in such a bold and blatant way is definitely something that the United States should be deeply concerned about. And what sort of steps, what sort of actions could America take that wouldn't escalate quickly?
Well, it is hard to see what they can do, actually. Yes, you can try and stop these vessels from getting across there. You can try and stop the planes or forbid the planes from arriving there. But this is actually something, although we're just seeing now the first tankers arrive from Iran, the relationship with Venezuela, between Venezuela and Iran, has been quite strong for a number of years, going back to the days of Khatami, the days when Hugo Chavez became into power in the early 2000s. And then as Maduro took over, this relationship has continued. And so, you know, to expect, although we're just seeing some really visible Iranian and Venezuelan relationship, a really visible relationship, this is something that is entrenched inside Venezuela. And they, too, both don't like America, and they're leaning on each other for help to try and maintain. Iran needs money there, and Venezuela needs petroleum, and so they're going to help each other through this. Now, we don't know exactly what's on these tankers. We could say that there is just petroleum on these tankers, but it's easy where you could stash materiel, weapons, things like that, or even just Iranian citizens, or IRGC fighters. Mm. The U.S. intelligence has said, the general that looks after the Southern Command based out of Florida, he said that on these Mayan Air flights, we know there's IRGC fighters coming. This is actually Iranian foot soldiers that are making their way through to Venezuela on these planes. We don't know whether they're going on the vessels as well, but this is pretty serious, definitely serious, looking at what's going on there. Now, this has gone on in terms of Iranians being entrenched in Venezuela for a long time. Right now, the oil minister of Venezuela, he was just made such. He's the second strongest man inside Venezuela. Assimi is his last name. He's born in Venezuela, but his mother is Lebanese, and his father is Assyrian, Syrian Druze. And he just became the oil minister and looks to be facilitating this relationship further between Iran and Maduro right now. But he's been the number two and even like holding position of power for such a long time. And as was brought out by a Politico piece back a couple of years ago, he was actually the very center of a scheme to raise funds for Hezbollah's international terrorist network. This is going back into the Obama administration. We had this Operation Cassandra, it was called, which blew the cover of this $200 million a month scheme that was pushing Venezuelan drugs up into the United States. And then the funds that came from that were laundered through a number of different ways into a Lebanese bank to the tune of $200 million a month. And is what funded the Hezbollah campaigns across the world, Hezbollah's missiles against Israel, all of that. And the Obama administration, because of its desire to have a nuclear deal with Iran, They did not bust up this, even though you had the Drug Enforcement Agency come to them, come to the different agencies of the United States, Justice Department, saying, hey, can we go after these guys, sanction these individuals? Assimi was one of them, the guy that's now organizing the oil, the petrol coming to Venezuela. He was one of the guys that the Drug Enforcement Agency in this operation 10 years ago wanted to try and arrest and stop the funding of Hezbollah through Venezuela. But it was the whole operation, water was thrown on it, and it died. And then you had the Trump administration come in power with his national security advisor, Flynn, who knew of the Iranian threat better than anyone else, and who was even writing in his book in 2016 and articles in 2016 about Iran, what Iran was doing in South America, in Venezuela. And he comes in, and within his first couple of weeks, he sanctions this very individual, Assimi, who is now basically an Iranian asset, or I don't know if I can call him an Iranian asset, but he has worked for Iran inside Venezuela for two decades now. And he is the second strongest man there who could have, he potentially could have been removed or arrested back during the Obama administration. And the Trump administration is trying to deal with him at this really real strengthened relationship. You even have some people writing, speculating that maybe Maduro is gone, or will be gone soon, and that this a friend of Iran, who's now the number two, will be replaced by him, which you could see then a stronger relationship between the chief state sponsor of terrorism, the number one enemy of the United States, as they would see it, Iran, being in right in America's backyard. Mm. And you just look at what's happened here over the past, let's say, decade. And it's eerily similar to what happened in Syria. And it's hard to think of Syria coming to the Western Hemisphere, but you had somebody like Assad that wasn't the leader, president of Syria, that wasn't a fanatical Islamist like the Iranians, but his rule was threatened. He was going to fall from power. He had an insurrection, and he called on Iran to come and help, and Iran did come and help. And now we've got Iranian entrenchment in Syria, using it as a conduit to fund, to give arms to Hezbollah, and part, for the past 5 years have used that as a launching pad for attacks against Israel. And some people are asking, are we seeing the Syriafication, if I could call it that, of Venezuela? We are. That's a couple of steps down the line, but this is definitely something that should be considered, seeing how Iran is making moves now with these big petroleum tankers into Venezuelan waters.
So this certainly highlights the nature of the Iranian regime and just how strongly anti-American it is, and how aggressive it is in implementing that kind of a policy. Looked at from the standpoint of prophecy, how do you see this? Why do you see this as being so important?
Well, it really does get back to looking at, I think, why the Obama administration allowed this to actually take place under their watch, the entrenchment of Iran inside Venezuela. And it was also they could pursue this Iran nuclear deal, which was, our editor-in-chief called, the worst foreign policy blunder in American history. And what's coming out now is it wasn't just about the Middle East. This was about, because they wanted that deal, they had to give Iran a free pass everywhere around the world. And the actions that we see in Venezuela are directly attributed to that deal, to the pursuit of that deal. And the executive editor of the Trumpet magazine wrote an article about how Iran was let off the hook in this area, Mr. Stephen Flurry, back a couple of years ago. And his article is entitled, Why Obama Blocked the Hezbollah Probe.
Well, more insight into just how determined the Obama administration was to make that deal go through, and what it was willing to do to ensure that, really is startling to see. We talked about that last week as well. We'll put a link to that article from Stephen Flurry on the show notes, Why Obama Blocked the Hezbollah Probe. And also Brent has an article that'll be coming up next Monday on this specific subject, so you can watch for that. Thank you, Brent. You're listening to Trumpet Hour. Coming up, China says it's building a tourist resort on a tiny remote island in Cambodia. So why is it planning to build an international airport with a runway big enough to accommodate China's long-range bombers and military transports? We'll talk about that when we get back.
This is the voice of the Trumpet News Magazine. You're listening to Trumpet Hour.
American troops should be commanded by American officers, shouldn't they? The U.S. military doesn't think that's such a necessity. This week, for the fourth time, they put a German brigadier general in charge of U.S. troops. For this story, we'll go to Richard Palmer.
Yes, on May 8th, the German brigadier general Jared Sembritsky, he became the chief of staff of the United States Army Europe. He had previously served as the commander of the 23rd Mountain Infantry Brigade in the German army. And like you said, the thing that's so remarkable about this is he's the fourth officer in a row now, German officer from the German army, to serve as the chief of staff of the American military in Europe. We wrote on this in the Trumpet print the very first time that this happened back in that was back in 2014. But now it's become kind of standard. It's become tradition. The post goes to a German. Now, the first time that happened, there was a fair bit of criticism of this decision to have a German put in charge here. That was under Mr. Obama, and some people were very skeptical of this. For example, U.S. Army Captain Terry M. Hestelow, he wrote letters to several American senators. And he wrote, President Obama has hit a new low in record betrayals. It is with absolute and terrible grief that I tell you President Obama has appointed a German brigadier general to serve as the chief of staff at the United States Army Europe Command headquarters in Wiesbaden, Germany. While this may seem difficult for many civilians to grasp, the gravity of this action, placing a German general officer in a U.S. command, is nonetheless a shocking and unprecedented betrayal by the commander-in-chief, President Obama, of the sovereignty of the United States and her magnificent military forces. So that was the reaction of at least one army captain then. Now, it's barely news. This is the normal at the moment.
And why is it so dangerous?
Right. So this is a huge level of trust that is being put into Germany here. Germany now is the only nation outside of the Five Eyes alliance that has had its officers put in command positions in the German military. So you've got the Five Eyes alliance that is America, Britain, Canada, Australia, New Zealand. This very close relationship where they share all kinds of military intelligence, pretty much the highest level of trust for America and its allies. But now you've got this, Germany being brought into a very similar level of trust to that, to the point that this chief of staff is going to be privy to a whole load of American secrets, American military doctrine, all these kind of things, and everything that goes on and that relates to Europe. So you're putting a huge level of trust in a foreign country in a way that wasn't done until just the last 6 years. And I think you look at not just the history of Germany, but just history of nations. And throughout all of history, nations looking to take advantage of other nations, nations looking to betray other nations. And even there's been various scandals just over the last 10 years or so of Germany spying on Americans, America spying on Germans, etc. So just that as a whole should be a warning. But we tend to kind of have this, history's over, we can all trust each other, nobody would work against each other kind of view. Then you look at what the Bible says, and you have an even more specific warning. There's a lot of specific prophecies that talk about America trusting in Germany, and then that trust being betrayed. And you heard from Andrew right at the start, and you're talking about some of these prophecies about America being punished, about race riots and things like that happening, and then other nations see an opportunity to take advantage of those riots. Well, Bible talks about Germany being one of those nations. I don't really have time to go through all of those different prophecies, but we do have an article on our website, German generals serving in the U.S. Army becomes a tradition. But America trusting in Germany is specifically prophesied, and we've seen now already America invest an unprecedented level of trust outside that close-up Five Eyes relationship in Germany. And then the Bible says that's not going to end well.
Yeah, you know, having the Bible view of this really does put it in the proper context. But it is remarkable that America is showing this level of credulity and trust, given the kind of reports that you're talking about, where you see that Germany really is not the ally that America has made it out to be. There's quite a lot of hostility from Germany in a lot of ways. And the fact that America would be doing this in spite of that, and just saying, well, they're expecting that there would be no consequences for it, really does tell you a lot about just the weakness in America today. But then again, you add that prophetic dimension to it, and it just becomes even more incredible that this is taking place. Well, we will link to that article from Josué Michels, German generals serving in the U.S. Army becoming a tradition, in the show notes. Thanks for that, Richard. So now let's talk about China's plans for this tourist resort on an island in Cambodia. It says it's just trying to create a nice little getaway, but the project plans don't seem to match that description at all. For this, we'll go back to Jeremiah Jacques.
Yes, Cambodia over the last few years has been drawing closer and closer to China. There was a really interesting report about this in The Interpreter yesterday, and it details the way the Cambodian leadership has just been granting China access to a naval base in Sihanoukville, and then it's also letting China build an airport and a deep sea port at Dar es Akor. We actually spoke about these developments last year when the news first broke about them, but they're all just forging ahead with apparently considerable speed. And there's also quite a lot of analysis in this piece about what you mentioned there, a facility that China and Cambodia are building in the Gulf of Thailand, and they're calling it a civilian resort, but all the signs point to military purposes for this facility. For one thing, it's able to accommodate about 6,000 people, but the number of tourists that ever visit this island at a time never reaches even half of that number. And then this facility also includes a massive new airport, even though Cambodia has a very well-working airport already built very close by. So it seems quite redundant if it truly is for civilian purposes. And then it also has a runway. Let me see. This is 2,650 meters long enough to accommodate really large planes, including China's long-range bombers and military transports. So all the signs really point to the fact that Cambodia is becoming China's second overseas military base after Djibouti there in the Horn of Africa. And one part of this interpreter piece talks about this. It says, these outposts in Cambodia could serve a strategic purpose for China, such as adding to its naval string of pearls, protecting shipping lanes, exploring the Gulf of Thailand's rich oil and gas deposits, defending Beijing's expansive claims to the South China Sea, and denying the U.S. access to the area. So it's, you know, it's quite a significant development and could be a major advance in China's goal of controlling more of Southeast Asia.
All right, well, we'll link to that article from a year ago. China's plans for global empire take a great leap forward in Cambodia in our show notes. And thank you for that, Jeremiah. Last Friday, we spoke about the EU's proposed bailout package for coronavirus relief, which could help the creation of a European superstate. This week, we got to see the European Commission's version of this proposal. To learn about this, we'll go back to Richard.
Yes, they put theirs forwards, and they made it even bigger. Last week, we were talking about a $500 billion bailout fund that was being proposed by France and Germany. This time, what they proposed was something was $750 billion, but made up the difference is made up with loans. So there would be a $500 billion on paper in grants. In reality, some of those grants are loans disguised as grants. The rest would be loans. And then we got to see some of the details on that. Geopolitical Futures went through some of those details and made a good point as to what some of the priorities of the European Commission have said would be in spending this money, and as well as Paris and Berlin. And they wrote that through their plan, Berlin and Paris are looking to establish a common European economic and industrial base, which means putting more power in the hands of Brussels. The area chosen suggests that the European Union wishes to be more independent from the outside world, focusing on building itself internally, and it talked about how in response to the coronavirus, it wanted to make sure it was less dependent on overseas trade and overseas supply lines, even on Russian energy imports. So it said that France and Germany regard this crisis as an opportunity to take on some of those challenges. And this crisis has shown Europeans how a flexible and secure, well, then just talks about how they're investing in more of their digital infrastructure as well. And so it says this focus, the focus on European interconnectedness and sovereignty points to a new step in European construction. So last time we talked about how this is forcing Europe to come up with something that's a bit more like a central treasury. And then you can see how they want to use this money just to build infrastructure links and businesses and supply lines in such a way that brings Europe together more. So you're still seeing now a strong commitment in response to this crisis in bringing Europe together. And that's the subject of one of the latest articles from Trumpet Editor-in-Chief Gerald Flurry on how the coronavirus is bringing this prophesied united Europe together. It's something we've forecast for decades, and his article in the Trumpet magazine shows exactly how coronavirus is helping that to happen.
Coronavirus and the Holy Roman Empire in Prophecy is the name of that article. We'll link to it on our show notes, and thank you, Richard. We'll finish with a story about food supply. The coronavirus has exposed the fragility of the supply chain and the potential for serious disruptions. For this, we'll go back to Andrew Miller.
Yeah, we have an article on thetrumpet.com now titled, "Is a Wave of Hunger Approaching?" by Daniel DeSanto. And it's talking about the supply chains of food, which normally that sounds like it might not be the most riveting of topics to delve into. Just the logistics of trucking routes and stuff like that, how your food gets there. But this is a huge threat for the nation, in that he points out here that, like I said, during coronavirus, like obviously, even with coronavirus, cows still give milk, chickens still lay eggs, tomato plants still bear fruit, and all these foods are coming here. So there's plenty of food. But with the quarantine and the shutdowns of businesses and things like that, the trucks aren't necessarily running, and a lot of the workers are laid off. A lot of the agricultural workers in the United States are like foreign workers that, with some of the national lockdown, they said that could even be an issue in the future. And so you're starting to see, well, maybe not food shortages yet, but at least prices of food going up quite a bit. In order to, you raise the price, you discourage people from buying stuff that they might not absolutely need, because they're just having a hard time of getting this food to market. And coronavirus, from a historical perspective, maybe it's the worst disease epidemic we've had in several years, but it's fairly mild compared to some of the big epidemics of the past. But it could show how you could have famine even in first world nations, potentially, even first world nations with with good weather. If a disease epidemic closes down supply lines, or if some like these race riots or something like that you're seeing in Milwaukee, if something like that got bad enough to close down supply lines, then you even get like food shortages, which stress people out and encourage them to do more like what they're doing in Milwaukee. The Mr. Fleury's book, The Ezekiel, The End Time Prophet, has a whole chapter on terrorism and race riots. That it talks a bit about supply lines too, there, about how in this Ezekiel 5 and verse 12 talks about like civil war and rioting in the nation that even produces famine. It's like I think in the past we'd even inferred that, it says in the book that maybe, well, famine could cause rioting and war, but sometimes rioting and war and disease causes famine if you disrupt the supply lines. And so it's like a vicious cycle. And something like coronavirus, I mean, it's not there's not massive food shortages across the United States. Daniel points out in this article that it's affected nations like Bangladesh and some of the third world nations worse than it's affected us. But it does at least expose the strategic vulnerability of how God could fulfill some of those prophecies in Ezekiel through something like we're seeing an enhanced version of what we're seeing now with racial tensions and a disease epidemic.
Quite an in-depth article by Daniel DeSanto there up on the trumpet.com right now. Is a wave of hunger approaching? Go check it out. Definitely worth a read. Thank you for that, Andrew. I'm Joel Hilliker, and that's it for today's Trumpet Hour. Email us your thoughts on the program to letters@thetrumpet.com. Thanks to our panel, Jeremiah Jacques, Andrew Miller, Richard Palmer, and Brent Noctegal. Thanks to Jeremiah for engineering and production. And I'll leave you with the words of Timothy Dexter. An ungrateful man is like a hog under a tree eating acorns, but never looking up to see where they came from. Thanks for joining us on Trumpet Hour. Until next time, keep watching your world.
You've been listening to Trumpet Hour on Trumpet Radio, 101.3 KPCG, and online at kpcg.fm. Understand your world.